Good morning and welcome to the Negotiators podcast. In this edition, I'm with Andrew Henley. Andrew's had a very interesting career. Firstly, as a military policeman, then as a police firearms officer, then as a barrister, and then in meditation, and as a yogi. I'm not quite sure what a yogi means, but I know it's very different from being a barrister. Welcome, Andrew. Thank you for joining me.
Yes, good morning, Derek. Lovely to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Andrew, can you tell me a little bit about your interesting career and why you went from firearms officer to a barrister?
Yeah, it's interesting. At that stage, I was in my early mid-20s, and intellectually, I was beginning to expand. I wasn't quite sure what was happening at the time, but all I knew was that the organisation of the police was too restricting and restrictive, and I came into conflict with some senior officers as I tried to express myself and my views, and I suppose my things like intuition were coming to the fore and levels of intelligence were clearly I didn't fit in the structure of the police, and it was a very difficult decision because I loved being a police officer, but clearly I was evolving and developing beyond the confines of that type of organisation.
So what made you decide to become a barrister? Because that's almost the opposite side of the fence.
I know. When I was a police sergeant over at Dorking, in the morning, you'd go in, you'd brief the troops, you'd sort out the admin. And then, funnily enough, in those days before the Crown Prosecution Service, I would pick up a bundle of files, go down to the magistrate's court, and prosecute the list. So it was so interesting. And when I got into that environment and I was presenting cases on behalf of the prosecution, I really enjoyed the courtroom structure. And so at some stage, I decided to think about becoming a barrister. And I contacted an ex-police officer who was then a solicitor and asked him about it. And then I'd gradually formulated this view. But it also coincided with my personal development, because I was looking for a real challenge, and the things that I'd done in the police and in the military were challenging, but I hadn't stretched myself. So I thought, what is the greatest challenge I could set myself in life as a young man? I didn't have any money, I had very little education, I had no contacts. So I thought, actually, a barrister, if I could achieve that, that would be something well worth pursuing.
So you set yourself a goal to become a barrister. So tell me, did you have to become a solicitor first? I know very little about the law.
No, you don't. What happens is that you get your academic legal qualification, and that's either a law degree or you have a conventional degree and you do a year's conversion. So you have that as your academic foundation. And then you decide whether to be a solicitor or a barrister. And if you wish to be a solicitor, you go in one direction, you take certain exams. If you wish to be a barrister, you go in a different direction. And the main difference is that if you think of it like going to the doctor, if you go to your doctor, who's a GP, a general practitioner, that's the equivalent to a solicitor. But if you want to go to a specialist, a consultant, that's a barrister. That's generally how it's perceived. There's been lots of changes nowadays, and there's much more fluidity between the two sides of the profession, but that's generally what it is.
So tell me about meditation and tell me about yoga and how all that fits into the quality of life, because a lot of people listening to the podcast will have a lot of stress, etc., and might be thinking about doing something about that themselves. What's your take on it and why did you do it?
When I returned from doing my work in Northern Ireland as an undercover detective, I think back then I was probably suffering some post-traumatic stress. I remember riding around on a motorbike for about 7 months just trying to clear my head. And then I began to get an interest in meditation. That was in my early 20s. So I started to develop an interest first, then I identified meditation as a technique, and then I pursued that. And I've searched three continents to try and find a master, because there's lots of charlatans around. took me about 15 years to find a master. But I pursued that alongside my professional life. And about 15 years ago, I introduced stress management to the bar through running courses for colleagues because they began to become curious about my absence in India and things like that. And I think meditation is the technique that kept me in balance despite all the stresses of being a criminal barrister and doing some very high level work. But it's the one thing that kept me grounded and still within my mind. And it added to my ability to be a successful barrister, the fact that I could meditate.
Interesting. I want to come back to the barrister later, but tell me a bit about going to India and finding the yogi master, or whatever you called him.
Yeah. Meditation is not understood in the West. And despite going to two or three groups in England, it was clear to me, my intuition told me that these people didn't know what they were doing. I mean, it may be spiritual, it may be to do with divinity and all the rest of it, but to me, you don't leave your common sense at the door of these places. So I went in there. I assessed the fact that these people didn't really understand what they were doing because they couldn't explain it clearly enough to me. So I went from England and then over to the States. My search was limited because of geography, but the people I went to, they clearly didn't know either. And eventually I ended up in the foothills of the Himalayas. And there from the what's called the cave monasteries up in the Himalayas, they send down people who are versed in a 5,000-year-old technique of meditation. And when I met these people and connected with them, these were clearly masters. Simplicity and the beauty of their teaching and their clarity, and also the fact that they could transmit energy and bring you into a state of awareness and consciousness. And when I met them, I knew that these were the masters I was seeking.
How much time did you spend with them?
I spent a month over there, connected with them, and I was initiated into the tradition, which means I was given a personal mantra by the head of the tradition, and that was my connection.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Yeah. Now, I'd like to return to being a lawyer, a barrister. Barrister is the right term. I remember you told me once that when you go into court and you assess the jury and you use some of these meditation skills to suss out the body language, a bit like I suss out the body language when I'm negotiating with people. Yeah. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, this is... I'm not going to give away any of my secrets, but I won't anyway because no one, I don't think that people will fully grasp these techniques, because I think you have to be a meditator. But anyway, the point is that when I go into court, most lawyers are left brain and they think in a conventional way. I'm very right brain, so I use felt thought, felt, F-E-L-T. I feel my way around things and I use my intuition. So when you're in court and you've got a jury of 12 people, the opportunity for communication between you as the barrister and them as the audience, the jury, is very, very limited and confined. You cannot have a direct conversation with them. The one opportunity you get to assess them is when each one of them individually stands up to take the oath or the affirmation. And during that, say, 20 to 30 seconds, there's an enormous amount of information available to you if you're paying attention to what's going on. And what I do, what my personal technique is that I don't engage my left brain. I do not try and analyze them as, let's say, a psychologist would. I allow myself to fall still, become fully in the present, which is a technique of meditation. And then I allow myself to connect. I watch and I listen. And through that process, I can find out as much as I need to know about the character and nature of those 12 people. And importantly, I identify the three main decision makers and how it is that they work, how well educated they are, how forceful they are as people. And then I plan the defense case, if I'm defending or prosecuting the prosecution case, around their psychology. How is it that I'm able to best communicate with these individuals, despite the fact that there's enormous barriers to communication, i.e., I can't have a conversation with them.
Sure.
But if you're fully in the present, you can sense and feel the change and mood of these individuals as you present information to them or to the court. You can almost sense it, almost like a changing colour of the group as their approach or their view about a piece of evidence will change. So that's how I use my
Okay, that's very
interpretation.
interesting. And of course, I teach the same thing on a negotiating course, to be fully present, as you mentioned, really listening, watching the body language, watching the mood of people, so that you can suss them out, and therefore you can make a decision. One of the tips I came across was going to peripheral vision, so that you absolutely kind of disengage the conscious mind, and you're more relaxed, and you can pick up more signals. And I'll write about that more in my newsletter. Turning to negotiations, you must have had some pretty tricky negotiations, and I take negotiations in the widest sense when I'm teaching and talking to people. So I mean, we're always negotiating 24/7, but you must have had some interesting negotiations with judges or in the police force. Can you think of an interesting one?
Yes, I remember being at Southwark Crown Court in front of a judge who had a very particular way of approaching matters. He was fair, but he was very firm. Behind me was a client who was extremely dishonest. But the difficulty about this negotiation was it was my view that the solicitor was also dishonest. So in front of me, I've got a judge who expected me to be to uphold the traditions of the bar with honesty and integrity, and yet behind me, I had two people manipulating the situation, and I
Wow.
was right in the middle. And I could see the judge required me to comply with my obligations, but my solicitor and his client were trying to manipulate, trying to use me as a pawn of manipulation in this process. And I tried to negotiate with the solicitor, explaining to him the consequences of their actions, the solicitor and the client, as they try to pursue this form of manipulation. And ultimately, the negotiation broke down because I refused to be their tool of manipulation. So I eventually withdrew from the case because I wouldn't be used in this way.
Sure. That's very interesting because that brings out two negotiating tactics, the things that you had to do there. You had to take time outs because you have to talk to these people individually. There's no way you can talk to them in a group. And you also have to have a walk away position. Sometimes your personal integrity in business gets questioned, and therefore you have to do what's right and walk away from a situation, even when you've been put into sometimes a compromising situation, which we all get into at some time.
I think that's right. You have to know what the limits are. And if someone tries to push you beyond the limits, then you have sometimes to walk away. It's very rare when it happens, but you have to know what the boundaries are.
One of the things that's always intrigued me, and I can't quite get my head around this, sometimes you'll be defending somebody who's clearly guilty. That's the law in the UK. Everyone's entitled to a fair trial, but how do you get your head around that?
You often get asked this one, and if we had more time, I'd make this story longer and more interesting. But very early on in my career, I was asked to represent a young man who'd been accused of rape. When I looked at the evidence, I was fairly convinced that he was guilty too, but I was there to defend him. And it was only when I started to challenge the evidence, and I discovered that the complainant in the case was a fraudster. She was actually set out. She had set out, in my view, to make a false allegation so that she could make a claim from the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board. And in this particular case, the police officer was involved in trying to cover up the fact that the complainant was a fraudster. Anyway, the point was that everyone, including me, believed that the client was guilty. But then when the evidence was tested and it all came out in court, it became clear to absolutely everyone, including the jury, that my client was completely innocent. So from a very early stage in your career, you don't question, or you question everything. But if your client says, "I am innocent," your job is to look at the evidence and discover whether or not he's innocent. But importantly, if your client says, "I am guilty, but I want you to get me off," you're duty bound to withdraw. You cannot represent a client who you know, who has told you that he's guilty. You can't do that.
Oh, okay.
Right. So yeah. It's only where it's this conflict with this internal conflict where you think someone's guilty, but he says he's innocent. You still have to represent him, but you know that the evidence is built by the prosecution. They build a case against a defendant, and if they've done their job properly, it should look like a good case. And your job is not to assume that the prosecution are correct. Your job is to question everything about their case if your client tells you that he's innocent.
Okay, well, thank goodness we live in a democratic society with the fairest system in the world. We're running out of time. Last question. You've been educating your daughter yourself, taking her out of school in this new model that the government's introduced. How does that work?
It's very interesting. I've got an older daughter who fits perfectly in the system, and she went to the local comprehensive school, George Abbott, which is a brilliant school, and she came out with 3 A's, which is great. But the younger one, who's 3 years younger, she has a different approach to learning. And there's a psychologist called Gardner who talks about 7 or 8 different styles of learning.
Howard Gardner, I remember, yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's clear to me that my youngest daughter thinks very differently to my eldest, and she is very frustrated in the school. There's nothing wrong with the school. It's just her nature is different. So I've had to withdraw her from school and give her different challenges because of her nature and her character. And it's quite clear to me, in fact, almost immediately I withdrew her from school. I knew it was the right thing to do. But you must engage them in a way which is appropriate for their learning abilities. So as long as you're aware of that, then you're safe. I feel quite confident that for my youngest daughter, taking her out of school was the best way to allow her to become educated in the way that suits her.
Fascinating. Andrew Henley, thanks for your time. So you started off as a military policeman, then as a police firearms officer, then trained as a barrister, and then ended up in the Himalayas with a yogi. What a fascinating life you've had. Thank you for spending the time on the Negotiators podcast. How does anyone that's interested in any of the things you do, whether they need a barrister or they need someone to help them with meditation, how do they get in contact with you?
Yeah, just remember my name, Andrew Henley. If you Google that, Andrew Henley Barrister, you'll get my website. Or if you Google Andrew Henley Meditator, then you'll come to a different website, which will give you access.
Brilliant. Thanks for spending time with me and for the listeners on the Negotiators podcast. Andrew Henley, thank you.
Thanks very much, Derek.
Thank you.